And welcome back, everybody. It's midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Joanne Martin founded the National Great Blacks in Wax Museum with her husband, the late Dr. Elmer Martin, back in 1983. Since then, many thousands of people have been to the museum on the west side on North Avenue near Broadway. With the opening in Washington of the National Museum of African American History and Culture happening this weekend, I thought we'd invite Dr. Martin to share her thoughts about the new museum and her own approach to telling the rich history of the African American experience. Dr. Martin joins me here in Studio A, along with David Fakunle. He's a self-described servant of the city, a fellow with the Baltimore City Health Department, and a doctoral student at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. You are welcome to join the conversation here on Midday. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wipr.org, or you can drop me a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. Welcome to you both. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Martin, your approach, your singular and unique and wonderful approach, I am a huge fan of Great Blacks in Wax. It's a great place. Tell us your philosophy about how you tell the story of Black history at Great Blacks in Wax Museum.
Well, of course, through the wax figure medium and wax figures that have a power all their own, but also being a museum where we are guided by my late husband, Elmer's philosophy that community development and cultural development go hand in hand. So within a backdrop of being in a fragile community in East Baltimore, the story unfolds, but also using wax figures for us right now to tell 5,000 years of history. Using wax figures as the central focus, but putting those wax figures in compelling scenes, being willing to be a museum with a message, that's very, very important for us, and being willing to tell parts of the story that other museums have for a long, long time not been willing to tell. So the slave ship experience, lynching in America, talking about some of the challenges of life in America today and so forth.
And it goes right through the present time, too, doesn't it?
Right through the present time.
There's a wonderful figure of President Obama there.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So from the slave experience through contemporary times.
Through contemporary times. And also following my husband's philosophy that if we fail to make those important connections between the past and the present, none of what we do makes any difference.
And again, I misspoke. I'm on a roll here for misspeaking this morning. You are on the east side, not
on
the
east
west side.
My Oliver community members will forgive you.
Exactly. Well, thank you. I'm glad to be forgiven. And David Fakunle, you are doing research in Baltimore that is also telling a very interesting story. Tell us about the work you're doing towards your doctoral degree at Hopkins.
Sure. So the concept that I follow with pretty much all of my research is the social determinants of health, which is a very big buzzword at Hopkins, but I try to make it matter in my context. So I focus on aspects of the built environment and how that plays a part in the outcomes for people in certain communities. So specifically what I'm looking at is the availability of tobacco, which is work that I kind of fell into before my senior year of undergrad. What I'm looking at specifically for my dissertation is looking at the influence of race and median household income as that relates to tobacco outlet density, which is just the physical availability of tobacco in certain areas. So my aim is to look at Baltimore County and to look at Montgomery County, which are two areas that are primarily white but have different income levels. And we want to see what the influence of median household income is among two racially comparable areas. So they're both high white, but they have different income levels. So we want to see if there's a relationship between income and tobacco outlet density. Similarly, for another aim of my dissertation, I want to take two areas with similar median household income, but have two distinct racial compositions. So I'm going to look at Baltimore County and I'm going to look at Prince George's County. One is predominantly white, one is predominantly black, but they have similar median household incomes. So I want to see that when isolating median household income, but looking at the racial composition, is there a relationship between that composition and tobacco outlet density?
A lot of people have done a lot of thinking and screaming and yelling and blathering on about liquor stores and about the availability of alcohol in impoverished neighborhoods. But I think almost nobody has taken up this notion of how easy is it to get tobacco products.
Absolutely. So alcohol outlet density and just the availability of liquor stores, particularly in Baltimore, has been a hot topic for a while. Actually, my former advisor at Hopkins, Dr. Deborah Fairholden, she's now at Michigan State University, was a big advocate for policy reform as it pertained to alcohol outlets. But like you said, there is very limited research on tobacco outlet density compared to alcohol outlet density. I think a lot has to do with just the perception of tobacco use. So I think we're all in agreement that tobacco is just not good. We know that, and we almost feel like that because we've come to that conclusion, oh, all the work has been done. But as you will see in Baltimore and a lot of urban, predominantly non-white, predominantly lower income areas, there is an abundance of tobacco products in those areas, and people are still using it at disproportionate rates compared to whites and those with higher incomes. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on that front, particularly in policy change to restrict the availability in those areas, because those areas are already fragile, as Dr. Martin said, as it is to begin with. So having an abundance of these detrimental products, whether it is tobacco, whether it's alcohol, whether it's lottery tickets, whether it's processed food, we can go on and on and on and on. That makes the disproportionate health outcomes, the disparities that we talk about a lot in public health research, even more profound.
Yeah, and of course, these are, these social determinants of medical outcomes. You know, Dr. Martin, it makes your job so complicated and so nuanced, because when you tell the experience of a people from the slave ships to the current times, you've got to take all these things into consideration. For example, when you hear about, you know, these events this week in Tulsa and in Charlotte, as a director, as an historian, what's your response?
Well, it's very, very important that that we address those issues. And often I look at them from a historic perspective. The same conversations that mothers are having with their young boys in particular, their male sons, about being not confronting and how to approach a policeman, how to deal with the situation. Those are the same kinds of conversations that slave mothers and slave parents had with slave mothers in particular had with their children. Those are the same conversations that parents had with their children during the lynching period and during the Jim Crow period. Those are the same conversations that my mother had with my my older brother, who was born in the 40s. Therefore those are the conversations that parents are having with their children today. That resonates for me.
Dr. Joanne Martin is the founder and director of the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum here in Baltimore on the east side. And David Fakunle is a doctoral researcher at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. It's midday. If you want to join the conversation with Dr. Martin and Mr. Fakunle, you can give us a buzz, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or a tweet at midday, Tom Hall. David Fakunle, you're a young African-American man in this city. Your reaction to what's going on, for example, these incidents in Baltimore County and in Tulsa and Charlotte, and unfortunately, it's a long, long list.
Yeah, and it's forever growing, unfortunately. So for me, it's just further confirmation that the United States of America has yet to fully acknowledge the humanity of people of color. And it just gets more egregious, that disregard for humanity, every single day. I really had to think about how I wanted to phrase what I want to say and how I feel, because there's so many emotions that run through my mind, not only as a young black man, but the father of a growing boy of color, my son, who's black and Latino. So I think about his future. I think about what city I'm going to leave for him, what country I'm going to leave for him. We have a lot of trauma. And that's another buzzword, but it's true. We have a lot of trauma that a lot of people are dealing with. And the question that I can ask, and I always ask as a researcher, as an advocate, as an artist, is what do we do? I think we truly have to appeal to the universal spirit of humanity in a lot of people. And they're missing that. You know, we get caught up in misperceptions, and we get caught up in policies, and we get caught up in ideologies for which a lot of people are invalid. So I think about Colin Kaepernick, and I know that's such a hot topic with him kneeling for the national anthem.
He's the San Francisco Giants quarterback. Yeah, exactly. That has started something of a movement among professional athletes in the NFL and other places.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a public acknowledgement that there are disparities and just inequitable treatment in such a holistic way. I know he's focusing a lot on police brutality. I get it. It's very visceral. It's very visual to see that when you see black bodies in the street being treated like trash. That's a very visceral sight, a very visceral reality for a lot of people of color to see that. And that's a traumatic experience. But again, as Dr. Martin said, this is just a cycle that's been going on and on and on since we were brought to this country against our will 400 plus years ago. You know, we've been commodified. So first we were cattle. We were products to be sold, to be used, to be bred for the building of this great nation, as so many people like to say. And then once that was outlawed from a policy standpoint, we were no longer of use. So they found different ways to control us. And all we've seen between 1865 and 2016 is just an evolution of those policies. And we've also seen the continuation of this false premise that blackness is evil. Blackness is vicious. Blackness is physical. Blackness is violent. Blackness cannot be controlled. It must be destroyed. And I think if anything, and I am so indebted to the National Great Blacks and Whites Museum for presenting this true reality of what it means to be black, not just in America, but to be black in this world.
Sure.
We are so much more than that. And that is all that I want people in the United States to see. We are so much more than that. And just at a fundamental level, why should a difference in melanin mean that I should be treated differently on a fundamental level?
Right, of course. And Dr. Martin, the capacity of history to address that narrative that David's just so compellingly and passionately put forth, which is a narrative shared by many, many people, that, you know, with now this opening on the Mall in Washington of what, by all reports, is this tremendous, tremendous achievement with the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which I think is an important distinction. Right. It's the same one that the Lewis Museum makes here in Baltimore for the Maryland African American or Maryland African American Museum of History and Culture. What is the capacity of history, and how can the National Museum move this conversation forward and inform people in an important way?
I think that as long as we remember that history does not occur in a vacuum, that the death of Emmett Till and the death of Trayvon Martin, that there is that connection. As long as we look at the whole Black Lives Matter movement, but understand that history will document for us whether the question is Black lives should matter as much as everybody else, or does it mean Black lives should matter, but they don't, or Black lives do matter. History has to address, look at those questions and ask those questions and make it clear that there's no single question being asked. And sometimes that gets lost in the shuffle, but it's the responsibility of history to look at those kinds of perspectives and look at the underbelly of the questions that get asked. It's important for us to pass on to our children, whoever those children are, that it is their responsibility to continue the legacy of this country, to continue the legacy of this world, and they do it better if they are just people, if they understand justice, if they understand equality. History can teach us that, because history can show us what happens when we don't. History can show us the fault lines, and that, for me, is the job of history. And it is the job of museums. The National Museum of African American History and Culture will do a tremendous job in telling that that story. But it's one of many, many museums across this nation. I had the privilege of visiting the International Civil Rights Museum in Greensboro, North Carolina, an outstanding museum.
Site of one of the first, important sit-ins in the civil rights movement. Sure.
Yes, mm-hmm. An outstanding museum telling a powerful story that is every bit as essential as the powerful story told by Great Blacks and Whites. And the story told by Great Blacks and Whites every bit as powerful as the story that will be told by the National Museum and all of the little stories that get told in museums. So that's one of the things. And for that museum to also be a repository of our history, the amazing collection that they've been able to amass that was languishing in basements or in the weather.
Yeah, some 35,000 yes. pieces and arts and artifacts.
And
yeah.
so to have a repository is very, very necessary for the continuation of African-American history and of American history. So that's an important role that it will play as well.
And David, speaking of storytelling, we have an email from Ramey, who says, I know David's a very talented storyteller and musician, but I'd like to know how he incorporates his research into his storytelling or vice versa. Is it about switching hats or do the two converge easily? So you've got this scientist side and this creative performer side.
So everything that I do plays a large part in my goals, which is to promote equity, which is to promote equality, and to promote recognition of the humanity of all, especially people of color. So I have thought of ways to merge the two, but I really appreciate my work as a practitioner. So I know Ramey, so I know what she's alluding to. One of the things that I'm most proud of during my experience at Hopkins was starting an intervention program with my mother. She and I are both storytellers. We've been storytellers for a very long time. I've been a storyteller since I was about 8 or 9 years old, learning under the late great mother, Mary Carter Smith, who was Maryland's official griot. And I have taken that art form, which is a universal art form, and mine happens to be under the African oral tradition. And I'm using that to empower individuals who are dealing with some form of trauma. So for the past about 3 years now, it'll be 3 years in December, we've been working with individuals who are in recovery from substance abuse and giving them the opportunity to tell their story. And the reason is for there's a number of reasons. Number one, their story deserves to be told and it deserves to be heard. They deserve to be empowered and deserve to speak for those who are dealing with that trauma. I think of this as a drug epidemiologist, which I guess is my research title, the training that I'm receiving at Hopkins. We are way too comfortable with trying to quantify everything. So one of the things that I would do in the meetings is I would point to somebody and say, you are a black male, we'll say 29 to 35 years old, former drug user. And that's all we would ever know about you in drug epidemiology. I would like to think there's more to you than that. So tell that to us as researchers, tell that to us as policymakers, tell that to us as advocates. Tell us the full story of who you are. You are not just defined by the fact that you were a former substance abuser. You are not just defined by the fact that you dealt with domestic violence. You are not just defined by the fact that you have dealt with police brutality. There's so much more to who you are as a person that needs to come out. And the biggest thing for me is to focus on those qualities of your nature. So we incorporate virtues into what we do, which are these positive intrinsic qualities. So we talk about patience as a virtue. Love is a virtue, the ultimate virtue. We talk about honesty being a virtue. These are things that are in every single person, regardless of what they do and regardless of the circumstances of their life. That should be the emotional foundation of your recovery from whatever your trauma is.
And Dr. Martin, speaking of trauma, one of the things that has been a great distinguishing characteristic of the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum is that you have held steadfast to your commitment to that neighborhood, which is a traumatized neighborhood, one of several on the east side. But folks may not realize that, you know, when tour bus fulls of folks come from all over the country, they do go to the Inner Harbor and they do all that, but they never pass up the opportunity to stop at the corner of North Avenue and Broadway. You have big plans for the museum, the physical exactly. plant of the museum. We've talked about it before on the morning show a couple years ago. Where do those stand? And you are hoping to expand the facility substantially, right?
To create a block-long museum, David and I are working hard to get interest in a arts and entertainment district in East Baltimore that uses Great Blacks and Wax as the anchor for that. We've demolished 16 of the 25 properties on North Avenue. We are working with our architect. We have an amazing design. We're working with our exhibit designers. We have a compelling story of over 250,000 years of history. So just moving things forward, but always continuing to address the desire to be a museum that provides jobs, that shows that tourism can thrive on a corner of East Bond Street and North and East North Avenue, and that there is so much more to that community that simply has not been tapped.
And you have had that kind of optimism and confidence since 1983.
And with David as someone who's going to follow me, it will never be lost.
Indeed. It is a pleasure to see you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know
Thank
there's
you.
A lot of attention being paid to the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, but that doesn't by any means attenuate the great significance of the great National Blacks and Wax Museum here
Thank
in Baltimore.
You. Thank you.
Thank you both. Dr. Joanne Martin is the founder, along with her husband, Dr. Elmer Martin, of the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum. David Fakunle is a self-described servant of the city. He's a fellow with the Baltimore City Health Department and a doctoral student at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. It's midday on 88.1 WIPR. Looking ahead to Monday, the next installment of our series, Living Questions, in which we explore the role of religion in the public sphere. My guests will be Rabbi Daniel Berg of Beth Am Synagogue in Reservoir Hill and the Reverend Gray Maggiano of Memorial Episcopal Church in Bolton Hill. Coming up here on midday today, the artist and activist Joyce Scott. On Wednesday, she was awarded a MacArthur Genius Grant. Joyce Scott, after a quick break, I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.